As middle and high school science teachers, when we set out to teach with the goal and expectations to transmit a collection of facts, or we're just teaching for the content, we create enormous pressure on our students to be correct. And those stakes are usually pretty high. Correct on tests, correct on homework, correct on lab activities or write-ups or notebooks. All assignments and scores that end up forming the foundation for a student's course grade in a marking period or over the course of the year, or even maybe in the high school, ending up on their transcripts. This pressure could totally backfire on us and work against us. Instead, reinforcing this lie that students tell themselves sometimes, like, I'm just not a science person. When in reality, maybe they just don't have a great memory or any kind of study strategy. Maybe they have no support at home. But what if instead we created a culture where we expected and rewarded students just for trying? And those trials only called upon students' natural, innate ability and desire to be curious. Then I think we could help students discover for themselves just how much science, just how much scientist is already in them. In today's message, I'm going to call this the confidence connection. And in my work, in my chemistry classroom, everything I do, including all the before teaching, all the planning, all the strategizing, it's about establishing this connection and strengthening it. After all, I think you agree with me when I propose that the confidence we can build in them and instill in them, especially at this very impressionable time in their development, will serve them long after the course is done, long after they're not our student anymore, long after they've probably forgotten all the content we're trying to teach. So in this episode, I'm going to offer up three things you might be doing in your middle school or high school science classroom that have the potential to crush student confidence. And of course, I'll offer up some alternatives that I use and I have found to be super helpful. And I work in a Title I school that's entirely online and serves a large population of at-risk learners. What's the message there? Is if it works for me, it's likely to work for you too. Hi, if we haven't met, I'm Lisa. I believe that middle school and high school science classrooms are a place for students' curiosity to run wild, a place where collaboration is commonplace and critical thinking skills are cultivated. That's why this channel is called Lab in Every Lesson. Because the more consistently we can offer opportunities for our students to engage in dynamic explorations and really hone their science skills, they are gonna better learn those science facts. And the more likely we are to impart true life skills, the kind of life skills that help our students become informed citizens who are capable and confident in making difficult decisions. Now, before we jump into those three confidence crushers, I do just want to blanket a little disclaimer here. Since our topic today is confidence, I want to remind you that I'm not an education researcher. I don't have a PhD in education in any specific area, and I'm not a psychologist. I'm a teacher in the trenches, just like you. And as a teacher in the trenches, it's really important for me to rely on the expertise that those people in those positions, psychologists and education researchers, can provide to help me better understand my students and better serve my students. They definitely play into the strategies that I devise to help them achieve their highest potential. So let's start by deferring then to the American Psychological Association to help us define and understand the role that self-esteem and confidence play in our students' learning. Here on their website, they note that self-esteem and confidence are required for students to take risks and to bounce back from adversity and challenge, that low self-esteem and low confidence make students hesitant to engage in learning. Now, for those of you who are watching and who have seen hundreds and maybe thousands of students pass through your classrooms, you might be giving a little giggle or ready to sign out of the video. Just don't hold the horses. Because I know you understand the signs and symptoms of low self-esteem and low confidence very well. But just so that we're all on the same page and keep this a real professional development message, I think it's useful to, and since they were so kind, the American Psychological Association, to lay out for us some very specific symptoms, we should take a look at those and see how they apply, maybe reflect on maybe some of the things we are seeing in our classrooms. The very first thing they note is that students begin to make disparaging comments about themselves. They might say things like, I'm stupid, or I just can't do this. You and I are more familiar with this in a very specific set of words that go something like, I'm just not a science person. And similarly, those of you who know math teachers or you have taught math, that's also a super common one. I'm just not a math person. As a chemistry teacher, I hear both because math is required in part of our chemistry classes, and the logic and reasoning that's required in science is actually applied to the math, so it's kind of full circle there for me. Or maybe, just maybe, you actually even heard it from a student's family member. In an attempt, perhaps, to excuse away some of the behaviors, the other low self-esteem, low confidence behaviors we're going to take a look at here. Things like giving up and disengaging from tasks, or even pretending they don't care or clowning around and creating distractive behavior for the other students. Now, I didn't read all of the bullet points in the list by the American Psychological Association because even if you take the time to, you come away with a very distinct and very clear theme, and that is that engagement goes down the toilet when there is a low self-esteem, low confidence problem. It can even extend into bad behavioral situations that do then start to be kind of contagious and affect the atmosphere or the culture in a classroom. I don't know a teacher anywhere, not anybody I know in a face-to-face environment or in my virtual school, who doesn't want and seek and try for higher student engagement, because across the board in education, I think every teacher would believe that the more a student engages, the more successful they will become. But I do wonder how many of those teachers suspect that confidence is the root cause of some of those engagement challenges. But if that's you, if you're like, yeah, me over here, I knew the confidence was an issue with the student, or I know it very well when I see it, why don't you share your story with us in the comments below? When were you first made aware of it? How many years into teaching were you able to identify it? What did you do about it? For me, I was already 10 years into teaching. And it happened the year that I was trying to overhaul my classroom, the year that I was really focusing on transforming what I did so I could transform what my students would do. The year I went all in on adding inquiry-based learning activities to every single one of my lessons. The year I required students to show me evidence of their learning and make their thinking visible for me. The year I really tried to make it all about the students and really take on that student-centered type of classroom. I remember even it was a lesson on introducing basic chemistry terminology. These are actually the task instructions I gave my students to work with. And I have to tell you, I felt very confident that this was simple and straightforward to execute. Remember, I can't show you any snippets of my actual activities, like previews that I show my students, because it violates some copyright stuff. So that's why it's blurred out there. But I think also my expectations were clear, not just in the task instructions. But I just told the students, I want you to play with this technology. I want you to come back and share what you did to play with the technology. And when you're playing with this technology, for which there was only three buttons that you would toggle on and off, tell me the order that you did them, basically, what you saw, what you learned, and come out with the intent or the goal of defining some of these key terms. based on your experience. The terms I wanted them to go after were things like atom and compound, mixture and pure substance. Because in chemistry, even at the end of the year, you still have some students calling an atom a molecule because they all want to call everything a molecule. After nearly 20 minutes of working on this activity, and remember now, if you're not familiar, I do work in a virtual online school. I do not have access to students' screens, so I can't see their actual real-time progress other than what they show me they are writing on a virtual whiteboard. So it was really that I was monitoring after 20 minutes, which is half of my class time, and like most of the students had nothing written down. I was totally confounded and panicking. I knew I couldn't move on to the next lesson because this was foundational, factual stuff. And in terms of disciplinary literacy, what students would read and understand in language they would use when we were talking together in class, this is like bare bones, basic stuff. And this is probably entirely for another video, but I do have to say, as a teacher in a choice school, where students are my students because they've chosen to work in our school, because they're probably escaping some aspect of another school, the biggest complaint we often get, or the biggest negative remark we often get about wherever the student came from in a school system, is that the teachers just kept going. They just kept going. They didn't understand, and the teacher just kept going anyway. That's for, like I said, a whole other video, because who even knows if the student made it clear to the teacher that they didn't understand, or, you know, maybe the teacher wasn't monitoring real well. Maybe the teacher was doing some of our confidence crushing things. That's not on today's list, but it really probably should be. Don't move on if you know the majority of your students are struggling. That's a big no-no. Anyway, I was only a week into the school year, and so I wasn't totally sure myself what this lack of engagement meant yet. Teaching like this in my school was not commonplace, and I was already on high alert. I'm a pretty excitable person, and I was pretty neurotic and paranoid about the fact that students would not accept me sort of imposing these kind of high expectations on them in our class time together, and I expected them. I tried to remain hopeful, okay, but I did expect them to revolt a little bit. Ultimately, I had so many suppositions, so many assumptions, so many possibilities swirling in my head over what is even happening here. I had no other choice, I believe, than to choose actively to believe that they just didn't understand, that they wouldn't commit to writing anything down that reflects their understanding because they didn't understand. I'm really good at turning short stories into long ones, so I'm going to end it here and just say this short story ended with me revising my artifact outline, but preserving the integrity of the actual task and the exploration, and just a few tweaks to what I would have them do to show their understanding turned out swimmingly. We had outstanding outcomes in the end for this activity. Realistically, there was probably so much more going on for my students than confusion. There was probably also some fear of being wrong, fear of a new system and new expectations, and fear is paralyzing. I mean, let's just time out for a moment, stop talking about students. I'm sure there's something you can recall that caused you a great deal of fear that wasn't necessarily threatening to your physical situation or your emotional well-being, but wow, I'm afraid to do that thing. And so it goes with our students. There was probably even some fear surrounding their work with me. We were only 3 to 5 lessons into the school year. They hadn't established any sort of trust relationship with me, any sort of, you know, we didn't have enough time to even get a feedback system in place. So I wasn't really sure of them, and they weren't really sure of me either. One thing I was absolutely sure of, after I decided to stick with the lesson, redo it the next day at the expense of whatever my pacing schedule had planned to be a little flexible and do this thing right, I was certain that from that point on, my students weren't going to proceed. They weren't going to take the next step any next step unless they felt secure. And I like to use the word confidence, confident in their capabilities, that whatever they put out there, made sense, that they were correct. And now, of course, you and I know that the process of science, it's not about correctness. All of our biggest, most famous, most notable scientists were wrong so many more times than they were right. And that is what we often miss out on when we're teaching collection of facts and we're not allowing students to be scientists. So let's go back to the American Psychological Association and see what they have to say about their recommendations for us in our role, our part in building self-esteem and confidence through our work with students. They write, "Self-esteem is often built and buttressed through estimable acts and achievements, even small ones." Okay, real talk here. Estimable, I think I'm saying it correctly, is not a word I ever heard of before. It kind of sounds like estimated, but that didn't fit the context for me. So we totally have to look this one up. Okay, the dictionary says it's a worthy of great respect. So we have an estimable act, an act that's worthy of great respect. And then the word buttress too, I was pretty able to work that out of context, but since we're being thorough, the dictionary says to buttress is to strengthen or support. So allow me to translate and summarize. The American Psychological Association believes that you and I can increase student self-esteem and confidence by supporting them through acts and achievements that present a challenge, even small ones. So we're not going to have this kumbaya campfire discussion about growth mindset with our students and tell them all about how their brains are still growing and the neurons are firing and what they can't do now, they'll be able to do soon because the power of yet. That's all amazing, awesome stuff for elementary school students. But in the middle and high school level, we need to show them. We need to give them the opportunity to set the pace for themselves, to explore, to try and maybe fail, to learn from their mistakes. And that is how we get growth mindset. And that is how we get self-esteem. And that's how we get confidence. Increase. This is increase, not just thumbs up. Maybe we can call this comfortable challenge. I think it was a principal. I'm going to show you his comments later. He called it productive challenge. That's a nice word too. Now, if you'd like my more detailed perspective on productive challenge, comfortable challenge, check out my video called Ramp Up the Rigor. I think that'll be time really well spent for you. Here we want to stay focused on this confidence goal though. But while you're making a note to check the link for that video in the description below, whether you're watching or listening, give this message a like if we're so far so good. You're maybe reflecting on some of your lessons and some of the content that really causes you trouble in your class with your students. And maybe you're starting to wonder if you're hearing crickets because of confidence issues. All of the confidence crushers I'm about to tell you about completely complement the suggestion that the American Psychological Association gave to us to support students through challenge. And please make note of the fact that I am using the word avoid here. In the title of this video, it said, avoid these three confidence crushers. I purposely didn't use the word stop because some of them we can't stop. Some of them are best practices. We just can't perpetuate them always. We can't take them to an extreme, you know? Everything's better in balance. So my very first thing I recommend avoiding is lecture and note-taking. They go together like peas in a pod. As a backbone of instructional design, what you're planning to deliver to your students, This is entirely passive. It's literally an attempt to transmit facts and figures, knowledge, from our brains into our student brains. And that's not a thing. The emphasis there, what we're actually expecting students to do, is rote memorization and the most basic level of introducing understanding, just recall. This is something that varies biologically in terms of ability for students or even adults to be able to do. I've even left a link in the description below to some research and an article by the science department at Stanford University about research that's happening and trying to discern why some students can recall better than others. It's a real thing. If you're interested in that brain chemistry biology stuff, go for it. I'm just going to keep moving on. Lecture is a one-size-fits-all approach, and it rarely calls upon students to do self-reflection. Think about how they connect with the content, how the content connects with our society, or any connection at all. It requires no higher-order thinking and no meaningful action. Even if you're asking scaffolded questions that you feel are more and more challenging as you go through the content. Answering follow-up questions in between spurts of lecture would likely not be considered an estimable act by the American Psychological Association during instruction. Remember, estimable means worthy of great respect. It is possible that if we're talking about acing a test at the end of a unit after all kinds of different instructional practices and strategies have been used, yeah, the student will probably feel pretty happy about that. But we're talking about during instruction strategies here. And with scaffolded questioning, there will probably be a limited sense of achievement there because a lot of times students might just make a lucky guess. So instead of lecture, let's lead our students through exploration. Exploration activities that we can plan for purposefully integrating various degrees of support. Because remember, the American Psychological Association said we want to support them through acts that are challenging. For me in my classroom, I've chosen inquiry-based strategies for the root and the core of my lesson planning because it most closely mimics science as practice by scientists in a lab anywhere, and it can be guided to various degrees because remember, we're after support and challenge. Everyone can observe. Everyone can report what they observe, and every student in your classroom can exchange those observations with another student or a small group of students. These types of challenges are small challenges that represent science that can be incorporated in the consistency of a routine with the intention of building confidence that they will be able to meet these expectations. Then, instead of scaffolding questioning, we can actually scaffold our plan. We can scaffold the things we want our students to do, like after they are observing and reporting on their observations, they're gonna try to cite some really specific evidence, come out with some inferences through analysis, and even conclusions. And then, voila, here we are at correct answers, just like scientists do. So ditch lecture and lead active learning. Then avoid filling up your grade books with assessment scores and homework completion or homework mastery scores. For a long time, I've really thought of myself in a teaching role as kind of like a doctor. Now, obviously, when I was a kid, and even for the first 10 years of my teaching, I didn't think of it that way. A test was a test, and a lecture was a lecture, and that was that. But no, since I've really all bought in on data-informed decision-making, I see all of my work as a means to diagnose a potential disruption. I need to know which students don't get it, which students do, which students are maybe a little of each. And I need to know what each of those students has mastery of, what content each of those students is on the way to mastering, and what content each of those students is just totally epic failing at. That's kind of what doctors do, right? We go to them, we get a test, they tell us what's the problem, and they tell us how to fix it. Assessments totally make that possible for us as teachers. But how helpful is it to know that information after instruction? Isn't it so much more helpful to us and to our students if we identify or redirect the misconceptions that seem to be happening before they become concrete, and we identify the things all the students are continually stumbling over before they take the test?
Yeah,
of course it is. And this isn't a novel concept. It's called formative assessment, and I'm absolutely sure that you make an attempt to do it and that you are achieving that in your classroom in some form. Maybe you use student performance on homework to accomplish this. And homework like this might certainly have its place. As a chemistry teacher, I totally believe there are certain tasks, certain skills students need to be able to know and do in the content that are absolutely strengthened through a drill style practice, doing it and doing it and doing it again to achieve mastery. Things like balancing chemical equations or predicting the charge on ions. Students always do better through practice. Practice makes progress, right? That's what we're getting to there. But when you're not looking over their shoulder while they're working the problems and you just see the final result, do you really get a sense for their problem-solving skills and the ease or the difficulty with which they're having that particular task? That's not to mention that there's an ocean of opportunities out there now with AI. And even in chemistry, even if it's not AI, I mean, I teach gas laws, and most recently I'm right now in the thick of mole conversions. Literally, I can't even give those types of problems for homework and have them mean anything because there are calculators online. Not a punch the number calculator, but a mole conversion calculator. I put in the number of moles, it spits out the number of grams.
What?
That's because in the end, students want to be correct. And they know that there is an unspoken expectation that their homework's correct. Our intention as teachers is good. We know that practice leads to progress. But for an insecure or less confident student, it might lead to shutdown. So instead, let's offer up an array of options, low stakes options for our students and tasks our students can complete so that they can show frequently and regularly what they can know and what they can do. And in planning these opportunities, we can plan for that range of what students will be able to know and do, because in our classrooms of 20 or 30 or more, there's a middle, but there's also a high and a low end. And we have to plan for all of them. Support isn't one size fits all. Not coincidentally, the science process is one that's accessible to every student. As I mentioned before, every student can make observations. Every student can report those observations, and every student can contribute them to a small group or a partner or a whole group. So why not give them credit for trying? Now, sidebar here. I get the sense that grades and grading is probably a controversial topic because there is this thing cropping up, if you haven't encountered it, called equitable grading. And equitable grading does not see scoring based on participation as something we should do. It's not a best practice. And I don't know much about that trend at all, because I haven't read up on it. But I do know that this is a human job. And just like any other theory or any other philosophy or any other proposition that someone's going to put out there, there's a range of interpretations on it. Case in point. I would argue that making students aware, making a clear expectation that in the classroom they're expected every day to contribute some artifact from an exploration, 1 point per day for trying, for recording some observations, for going through the tasks as they're laid out. I would argue that's totally equitable, and I would argue that because that's why I do it. That's exactly the reason why I decided every day I need to produce something. My students need to produce something. I need to give to them, and they need to give back to me, because I need to constantly be measuring or ballparking what their abilities are. I would also argue that it boosts student confidence. And when I put it in the gradebook after 9 weeks or a semester, it's an A for effort. And it compensates for maybe a little bit of a lack of understanding. When I decided to do this, I was going for an appreciation, an acknowledgement that I was noticing students trying. And it's low stakes. There isn't one correct answer. And in fact, the more I can collect student responses and show those responses, the more they can all contribute to, hey, look at what we ended up with, the more students will see that there is not one way to express what they found. And so there is not one correct answer, but they'll see a theme or a general concept emerge as a correct answer. And it reflects students' individualism in that way. Their true understanding comes through if they keep an open mind and give 100%. It also provides me with very valuable numerical data to share with their families and concerned or support staff. I can basically, what it does, but if it's 1 point per day, it summarizes or reflects an amount of time that the students are in class and with me and that they are invested and that they are trying. And then we can compare that to assessment scores and make sense of it. Does it make sense that the student is applying all this effort and not seeing the fruits of their labor? Or conversely, does it make sense that a student is not putting in any effort and not seeing the fruits of their labor? Okay, so it's a little bit of backup evidence as well. Conversely, I would definitely not call assigning a homework problem every day or a homework assignment every day for 1 point to achieve that same effect equitable, because many of those students may not have even felt prepared to begin it or get through it to complete it. In fact, this practice might actually encourage our students to seek the solution elsewhere just to get it done and fulfill the requirement. Now, aside from including science practice skills in your everyday classwork to encourage those low stakes or provide more of those low stakes opportunities for your students to engage and show what they know, incorporating more student choice will open up a world of possibilities if this is something you're trying to achieve. As part of the requirements for my chemistry course, I have it set up so that my students have an ongoing expectation all year long that they will complete a practice assignment that's connected to a third-party website. And I'll leave the link to that website in the description below if you're interested. Now, with these weekly practice assignments, it's entirely my intention that students are going to do some of that drill-like practice, that they're going to hone in on the core ideas and the specific content-related skills they're going to need to earn high scores on their tests, not unlike any conventional homework assignment you might assign a student, except that I allow them to choose the topic.
Whoa.
I create the list from a data bank, and the data bank is huge. So to ensure that my students are always practicing something that we have learned at some point throughout the school year, or maybe more focused on a marking period or a semester, I maintain a list and they do use that list. But they have full choice of what they're going to practice on any given week. 1 week, they might choose to complement what we're doing in class by practicing that particular skill. Maybe it's balancing chemical equations. On another week, they are totally overloaded with lots of tests or term papers and assignments, and they just don't have the time or the brain power to invest in chemistry. So maybe they're going to complete the practice on the scientific method or physical properties of materials. Something they know is kind of easy, what we would consider low stakes. There's not a lot of investment. They're not going to feel hurt if they come out the other end not knowing a whole lot, or they're probably choosing something they're very confident in. The following week, we might have just had a test, and they might have seen the outcome of their test and seen what they didn't do well on and chose that topic so that they could go back and relearn, because this website and these practices, do some amazing things for students when they're in the practice. They provide multiple chances to get a correct answer, first of all, and they do offer hints. And then if there are repeated attempts, a student gets the problem wrong, they can connect to instructional resources, articles and videos that will help them learn those concepts better. So in that way, incorporating student choice and increasing student agency does so much more than just increase their confidence. When we give students the opportunity to make choices, they're owning a part of the process. They're beginning to learn how to learn. Is it cliche to say lifelong learner? Because it is a thing. And hopefully, that's our end goal. On these particular weekly practice assignments I give my chemistry students, I get amazing engagement, far exceeding any other assignment I tally up and record in my gradebook. The third and final confidence crusher you want to avoid is siloing your students. Yes, I said siloing, as in creating an atmosphere where they are by themselves. And you might be thinking, how's that possible? I am never isolating students in my classroom. Who even does that? No. When we lecture from the front of the room, we speak to an entire whole group of students. And when we do this day after day as our primary method or primary strategy of instruction, we're really causing our students to withdraw, to like put themselves back in their turtle shell, even though they're physically surrounded by other students. There's a sort of tunnel vision that starts to happen. They're accountable for themselves, to only themselves, and whatever they've written down on their paper, because presumably, if you're lecturing, you're assuming they're taking notes dutifully. Or let's be real, sometimes they're just pretending to write things, or they're drawing very beautiful pictures. Maybe not. Maybe some are starting to solve the problem you just outlined on the board or put up on your projector, but they can't finish them. They can be afraid to raise their hand and ask for help because that'll draw attention. And especially now, it's 2024, we're in a world that is driven by social media. And even me myself as an adult, when I get on there, I can't help but feel like this one has more, that one's doing better, that one is better. And our young kiddos have to feel the same way. So surely if I'm sitting in a classroom and the teacher's doing the thing and everybody else is doing their thing and I can't see what all the other people are doing, absolutely, I'm not measuring up. Now you have to remember, my perspective is that of a Title I school in an online environment where students have chosen to come because they're at risk. They've already experienced all these things and they definitely don't want to raise their hands. Not with me. I never have a student raise their hand. I don't know how many times in all the years, unless I've asked for it to volunteer for something. Very, very few questions. So at some point, I learned that it's not going to be efficient or effective for me to ask, does anybody have any questions? Instead, I'll be proactive and I'll make sure that that student knows I will serve them, I will connect with them, we'll find out what's their need or what they're struggling with without them having to ask the question. So instead of spending the majority of your time paying attention to the whole group and having the whole group look back at you, commit to spending a certain amount of time with every student every day. Now, I got you. In some of your classes, you have upwards of 30 students. It's like not a thing. So take it down a notch. Maybe every student every week. Making that touch point becomes really important to them knowing that you're there as a support structure for them. Remember, the American Psychological Association says we are to buttress their, what was it? Estimable acts. You want to let them know in the long term, through your actions, not only your words, that you're going to be there to help them when they fall, when they falter, maybe even before. One way you can get to know exactly who needs you and for about how long is to really closely observe every student's work every day. Of course, that implies that you're going to give them something to do every day, to show what they know and make their thinking visible. And then when it's great, you want to praise them so hard for doing great. And you want to show off that greatness to the rest of the class. And making this a regular occurring thing in your class is really going to build community. It's going to get those kids out of their shells because they're going to see that everybody has a strength, that everybody can do it well, and they're all going to feel like they are part of that contribution where they too are doing something great. And I'm not just referring to facts and figures here either. I'm not just going to pull out Johnny who balanced this chemical equation perfectly. If you're using active learning strategies and you're having students work through those cross-cutting concepts of science, or even if you're not, and you're working on that lecture lab style of instruction, you have lab day. You are able to point out when a student makes a great observation, you're, hey, that was a great observation. High five. Gold star, whatever you do. Observations are critical to the process of science and learning things and troubleshooting and solving problems. Or maybe you're working through a solution to something together with the whole group, and a student does step out and they ask a real quality question. They are already, you can tell, starting to make connections with the content or the discussion and how it connects to themselves or how it connects to the class or how it connects to the world. And you're like, oh, that's a really quality question. Questioning is central to science. Maybe a student wrote or explained something in a really clear way. Or maybe there was some small group work happening and you really saw them stand out as a leader or support the leader, kind of give an assist there if we're talking sports analogies. These kinds of skills are science skills. And if you give your students the opportunity to practice them, you're also giving yourself the opportunity to reward them. Feedback and praise becomes piece of cake. I actually created a very specific system for rewarding these types of science skills and praising students really specifically for the work they do in my class. The badges I award are right here, pictured behind me. And when I teach them every day, we're on the webcam, so they see them. And I like them there as a visual reminder of what we're really going after here together, them and me together as a learning community. They don't wonder about what I think is important when we're learning. Whatever we're learning. I do sell this system and it includes these badges and a whole bunch of trackers. I'll also leave that link in the description below. However you do it, the more you can reward the challenging act of science practice and the process of science and make accomplishment less about correctness, the more confidence you'll build in your classroom. I'd like to take a moment here actually and let my students speak, give them a voice in this particular episode, because I do feel like I'm taking a few liberties with telling you that my students come out feeling a certain way, like they experience emotions and I'm having some part to play in that. I do actually have evidence to support that and I really do want you to see it. I've treated my classroom as a laboratory. Yes, I came out with a plan and I implemented the plan, but I was totally aware at every stage and every step that I was impacting the life of many children. And that's my whole goal. Like, I'm in this to make a difference, and I know you are too. So I ask students, how did you feel about this? What did you like best? What do you think about our classroom culture? And when they're asked, they're truly not shy about sharing. I also think that when I ask their opinion and their ideas, they know that I'm still in a stage of learning myself, that I'm still invested, and that I really do care. That whatever they can contribute might actually make the circumstances better for another student later down the line. So I'm considering this feedback that I'm going to share with you to be evidence of all that I have discussed here today. And many of them, I think, were meant to be kind, glowing compliments of me and the way I run class and some of the different things I've added to my strategy over time. Please know that I am not sharing them with you to lift myself up or inflate my own ego, because I'm not. But I do work in a really unique environment, one where students don't have to use their words, like their voice box, to share their ideas or their feelings. In fact, most of my communication with them happens in a chat box and an email. So when I ask these questions, you know, it's human nature at this point in our society anyway. It's much easier to write or type what we think and feel than it is to actually say it. So I do have this, I'm in this unique position to be able to collect and share. And I really want you to understand that whatever these students share is not going to be anything unique and different from what your students would share in the same situation, as long as you continue to avoid those confidence crushers we talked about. This student says, "When I don't talk, it's usually because I'm nervous or I'm not 100% sure." Now, we might not call that low self-esteem. For me personally, I'm feeling like low self-esteem is a bigger, badder issue, but definitely that's a nod to confidence, at least in the content. This student says, "I came into this class after a year of struggles. Instead, I got a year of knowledge and encouragement." This student says, "Also, thank you for all the good jobs." Students love praise. And I mean, who doesn't? You know who eats praise up, like for dinner? This girl. So if you haven't hit that like button yet, please do. Send me all those good vibes. This next comment is one of my favorite ones. I cherish it like gold in my smile file library. Jacob says, "Mrs. Kuro says, I want to thank you for being my science teacher. Although I'm asynchronous, I've enjoyed logging into your class this entire year." Just time out a minute. That means he didn't have to come to class, but he chose to come to class. "I've learned so much in regards to the different aspects of science that I didn't know existed. You've really challenged my mind in ways I didn't think I could understand. That means I didn't believe I could do it, but you made it possible. Also, I'm not a very vocal or social person, but being in your class has made it easy for me to be comfortable in myself." You know why? Because I didn't require Jacob to share his responses aloud. I just grabbed his amazing work and shared it on his behalf. And sometimes I might say, "Hey, this was Jacob's, prop to Jacob." And sometimes I wouldn't and just say, "This was amazing. Check it out. This is what we want to aspire to." And there's two more here. Another one kind of along the same lines says, "Mrs. Grosses, I love how communicative you are with me and all the students. Remember I said we want to touch with all the students?" This student knew that I didn't just touch with her, check in with her like regular, but always. And she knew I did it with all the students. "I appreciate that you understand my abilities in class." Do you know where I'm going here? Do you see this? This is evidence. They know that I know where they're at all the time. And I make decisions based on it. "You let me work how I want to with things like moving to my own breakout room during class to work on my own problems. Love how flexible you teach your class and how you don't just assume everyone in the class is at the same level of understanding." This student says, "Thank you so much. Science has never been a favorite subject of mine." This is our not a science person student, because I'm never able to fully grasp it. "This year, though, you made it my favorite class of the year, and I was finally able to understand it." And this last comment I'm bringing to you is actually not from a student at all. It's from my assistant principal, the person that I report to. He had been visiting class. I don't think this was a formal observation kind of moment, but just an anecdotal he walked through, and this is what was happening. He writes, "It was great getting into your chem class. I thought it was a great question to see. Balancing the reaction was challenging, and what I liked most was that you let the students figure it out. They struggled with getting that monster balance, and you let them have the time to learn. I loved the wait time. You gave them time to explain their thinking and their reasoning. You let them make mistakes and go down a path that wasn't going to lead to the correct response, and that was okay. With such a great environment you created for," there it is, "productive struggle in a place they knew they were able to be safe and explore and learn." And that's what it's all about. As a teacher in an online environment, I've sorted out a whole system to do all the things I've recommended here without a huge time suck or investment, and in a way that you can pick it up real easily and fluently. But as an online science teacher, I obviously rely heavily on ed tech tools to get me there. And lucky for you, I created a video all about it. It's super powered PD if you put it to use. So block off an hour on your calendar. Yep, it's 50 minutes. And sit at your desktop so that you can work along with me. And then come back here every Thursday so you can realize even more powerful possibilities for your science teaching practice.